Enterprise Linux Security is brought to you by TuxCare, a company that helps you modernize your Linux security. Definitely check out TuxCare to see how they can help you automate Linux patching while minimizing downtime, staying compliant, and ensuring business continuity. Check them out at TuxCare.com. Hello and welcome back to Enterprise Linux Security, episode 104, where there's currently no drones over my house. How you doing, Zhao?
All good. It's always a pleasure. Yeah, the drone story, there's something there for sure. Probably just airplanes or something, but yeah, there's definitely something flying overhead.
I sometimes wonder if alien or UFO sightings, like, you know, the alien kind, are going to just be a thing of the past at some point in the future, because nobody will know if it's an actual alien ship or somebody's drone.
Or an Amazon delivery drone, for example.
Oh yeah. Boy. Yeah. That's interesting. So we have, speaking of interesting, several stories to talk about. And the headline in the first story is just pretty direct, I'm going to say. It says, AI slop is hurting security. LLMs are dumb and people are dim. That's very direct.
It basically just offers you the entire game plan right there in the title, right?
Yep, it sure does.
So, yeah, the short version of that, the TLDR version of it, is that open source developers are just wasting time debugging bogus AI vulnerability reports because they're receiving so many vulnerability reports that are clearly AI generated, and that then they still need to analyze and they still need to go over it. That it's, again, not even funny anymore. So, yeah, no. Really a long time being wasted in that type of things. And we're going to go into a bit more detail into that story, into why that actually matters, and everybody should be a bit more concerned about it. But the thing with AI is that it's not just polluting social networks and creating content that's essentially crap. And yeah, I guess a few months back when I was very overhyped about AI, I just falling down that cliff of shattered illusions there on AI. And it's the valley of disappointment right now. So right. Yeah, still waiting for the good days ahead of AI to come true.
I think, in my opinion, I feel the same about AI as I do hoverboards. You know, when I think of hoverboards, I think of Marty McFly, you know, Back to the Future on one of those hoverboards where he's just, you know, it's like a hovering skateboard. But hoverboards are this, in the real life now, are this wheel with a platform on it. That's not really what I had in mind when I thought of what a hoverboard would be in the future. And AI today is not what I thought AI would be in the future when I was younger. I thought it would be, you know, I remember how excited Scotty was talking to his computer in Star Trek IV, or the 80s computer. He grabs a mouse and says, computer. Because, you know, to him, he's trying to talk to a computer because that's all he knows. So I'm thinking of AI like something of that. And, you know, basically what it is a question and answer system. I personally feel like the AI revolution that we're seeing is probably just going to culminate in something stupid, like it's the successor to the keyboard and mouse, and that all it ends up being. However, the problem with AI, just to your point, is that it's so inaccurate. I feel like AI is kind of like this alpha software that was released too, you know, prematurely. Like maybe if they developed it for 4 or 5 more years before the AI craze started. You know, we have Apple jumping on this and all the other companies jumping on this, but it's just not accurate. Like I've had so many problems with accuracy. Like I would go on there and ask it, you know, I have this problem in Ansible. I think it was a GNOME desktop. I wanted to configure the favorites and I found the string array that it was in. And I just asked ChatGPT to write a play that would insert a name of an application into the string, leaving all the other ones there, and it produced this code and it looked like it was authentic. I was like, wow, that is smart. Of course it would look like that. And then it just doesn't work at all. And on the worst side of things, I've heard in the news that, you know, someone apparently, and I'm paraphrasing this because it was a long time ago, but asked an AI bot about a cure for some sickness and it told them to drink cyanide. Okay, yeah, it would cure the sickness. The person's dead, but nobody should be doing that. But the AI calculated like it would kill the sickness. But the reality is it's just so off all the time. And then when it gets to submitting bug reports that developers need in order to maintain their software, that just means that they have to now go through a bunch of crap to see what's actually real, what's not, a false positive, or, you know, a college student that finds what they think is a bug but actually isn't. And that pretty much gets us right into the first story.
Yeah. There's actually two interesting things about this. First is that AI is going through, obviously, a revolution, but it isn't the first, it isn't even the second or third. There have been quite a few revolutions in the AI space over the years.
Talk about Clippy for a Microsoft Word?
I wasn't going to go solo.
I had to.
But really, in the 80s, late 70s, there was all this hype about genetic algorithms. And then you had neural networks. Then you have large language models right now. And again, if you have this solution, you want to find the perfect problem for it, and it's being trickier than people expected a few months back or even a couple of years ago. But there is another side to this, which is something that's called the AI effect, which says that essentially whenever AI manages to solve a task, then you no longer consider it to be anything special because it's already solved. So when AI managed to beat the world best chess player with Big Blue, it's no longer newsworthy if some AI agent out there beats a human player, because it has been done before. It became almost trivialized. And this happens every time there's something good that comes out of AI, and we no longer consider it even to be artificial intelligence. I mean, we have code analysis, we have static analysis tools, we have lots of helpers when we're coding, we have all of those things, and we are just taking them for granted right now. And I'm not even talking about using ChatGPT or Copilot or anything while you're coding. I'm talking about all of the assistances and the aids and the autocompletes that you would get from your coding environment just 3 or 4 years ago.
IntelliSense,
for example. And the thing is, the problem right now that open source developers are facing with the amount of vulnerability reports that they're getting is that, like you said, it's probably coming out of undergraduate works at multiple universities, that they see that, yeah, this is an opportunity to find vulnerabilities, this is an opportunity to make a mark, to add something to my curriculum that I'm going to need a year or two when I'm going to apply for a job somewhere, and this is going to be huge. But it isn't. They're essentially throwing random pieces of code at large language models and, okay, find me a vulnerability here and write me a bug report that I can send the author. And that's all there is. And the effort that it takes to create those bug reports, the effort that it takes to find those bugs, is essentially nothing compared to the effort that it takes to analyze the bug reports, debunk them as being fake or not even security issues. And that is just taking away useless time and effective time from developers that are essentially just volunteering that time to the project. And that's a problem, because that's time that could be better spent actually doing code or improvements on their projects. So This is detrimental for everybody depending on open source projects.
And we also have to understand, too, that it's not just, spending time on the code. These people the developers have to spend time refuting bogus bug reports. And some, you know, when you're dealing with all kinds of companies that are using your code, especially if you have a CTO that doesn't quite understand how things work and their mindset is got to get all the fixes for all the security patches, and there's three on the list, and trying to convince them that two of them are bogus, and that's really not an easy feat. But why would they be bogus? Well, the article mentioned an example where a software project was using SSL version 2, or it was detected that SSL version 2 was being used, but it was only being used to disable SSL version 2. It wasn't actually using it. It just had some code that was, if I understand correctly, looking for it and closing that down because it shouldn't be used. But an AI bot sees that code and says, well, you have SSL version 2. You're mentioning it right there in the code, so you must be using it. And then a bug report is filed. So now somebody has to either create a fake update just to make the bot happy, or spend time trying to lead someone to understand that this isn't really a problem.
And that's part of the problem in how we approach cybersecurity right now, is that we have the entire system focused around CVEs. And whenever somebody throws a new vulnerability report and gets a CVE assigned, then you have all the tools and, like you say, all the CEOs and all the CIOs looking at that. Oh, we have a vulnerability. We're using that piece of software. We need to patch this immediately. Where is the update for this? So now the developers, and they mentioned this in the article, they have no good way of debunking that CVE. It has already been created, so they'll just bump the version number and say that it's fixed, even though it's just crap. Right, that's coming out.
Version 1.00-1.
Yeah.
Something
but
like that.
But that wasted right. valuable resources. That wasted time. That was just, again, wasted effort. And the burden of that falls onto the developer's shoulders. Whoever is just submitting the bug reports, they can just submit 10 new ones or 100 new ones because AI will always find something. You're missing a comma here. You have too many spaces. You have whatever. They don't actually have to be security vulnerabilities, like you say. It could be code that never gets run because somebody else in another place in the code, it's being blocked or it's never called or something like that. They don't understand context. They don't understand right. the intent behind the code. And that becomes a problem, especially in larger projects where it's really difficult to get a grasp of what's happening on all parts of the code when something is running. So it's really tricky to understand that if it's an actual problem or not when you get the report. So you right. need to waste the effort. And this is something that developers know very well. Even if it's your code, if you've written it like 6 months ago, it might as well have been written by somebody else. You won't remember it. You'll have to waste a really yeah. long time getting back into the mindset of why you wrote it. You'll have to go through all of the comments. You'll have to trace the code. You'll have to look at everything again, just as if it was new code that you had never seen before. Right. And that takes a lot of effort. That takes a lot of conscious effort that you're not using for something else. And your time is very limited.
Now, earlier I mentioned an example with Ansible and ChatGPT where I asked ChatGPT to generate some Ansible code that looked correct but really wasn't. This hits the developers as well because it's really hard to understand what is a real issue or not in terms of code because these, you know, ChatGPTs and equivalent are creating code that looks legitimate. They're looking at the code syntax and they put the right number of spaces in there. I thought that code was correct. When I looked at it, I thought it was brilliant. I'm like, that's great. That is probably exactly the textbook example of how it should be, but it didn't work. Now imagine a developer getting a vulnerability report with code that doesn't compile. Okay. This is what the article mentioned. The code they've received like a proof of concept code that doesn't even compile. Like the person didn't even bother to try to compile it themselves. And, you know, it hit me just with a simple personal Ansible project. But imagine a developer getting, you know, 10 bug reports and only one of them are, you know, something they should be spending their time on. It's ridiculous.
Whoever is submitting those, they don't even bother checking. And the thing with the code that you get, like you mentioned your Ansible example, I've been using ChatGPT to generate lots of scripts and all of that I regularly use in my systems. But it always takes some back and forth and lots of iterations and you got this wrong, this line doesn't make sense, this doesn't work as you intended it, you need to fix this, the formatting is wrong. There's a lot of back and forth until you actually get to what you actually need. And the code looks yep. great on every single iteration. It's brilliant code. They use all the right variables, all the right commands, all the right syntax, effective algorithms all around. But then everything put together doesn't actually get you to where you want to go. And you need to understand that. And it takes some trial and error until it works. And when it does, it looks amazing. But it's not just the first version that you get that's going to get you there. You need to check it. You need to validate that. And whoever is submitting these bug reports, and this is especially egregious in this example, is not taking the time and the effort to do that. So right. if you really need to create a new CVE, if you really want to get your name behind the CVE and you think that's going to land you a nice job in cybersecurity, please put in the effort doing that. Don't just fire code at your large language model of choice and take whatever comes out as being correct, because it might not be. Actually, most of the time it won't be correct. So put in the effort, look at the actual code, look at what you're being given by the large language model, make sure that it's an actual vulnerability. Do your proper analysis and your due diligence there before you actually submit those vulnerabilities. Because at right. the end, you're just DOSing the developers. It's what you're doing, nothing else.
It's just like the cash grab version of a fame grab. It's just like they want the points. It's not, no. Yeah. And the thing is, we have to keep in mind, many of these developers are volunteers. Okay. This could have a disastrous effect. I mean, people can only take so much before they give up, right? I mean, some developers are going to be more resilient than others. Some will just stick through to the end. Others will, you know, wade through all these and say, it's just not worth it. I just need to do something else because, you know, it sucks the fun out of it. And then software quality goes down. So this could be a cascading thing that might not stop where, you know, when it comes to bug reports. I think we're going to find other places where this is a problem, I think.
Okay, moving on. So another place where we know there are problems, remember that story about Chinese hackers being inside of 8 of the major telecom operators in the US?
Salt Typhoon.
Yeah, Salt Typhoon, exactly. So it looks like the rabbit hole actually goes deeper. Right now, the government isn't sure if they're still there or not yet, if they're still in the networks or not. The actual telecom operators, they don't know if they're still hacked or not, if their networks are still secure or the attackers are still inside. Essentially, because they don't know exactly how the hack was perpetrated, they weren't looking because they went through and this is ridiculous even saying it. They used the backdoor that was mandated to be in those networks, and that backdoor was so good that they were unable to track whatever happened behind it. So they're not sure if the attacker is still there or not. And that opens up a whole new can of worms.
And even the article mentioned that it could be measured in years, how long it takes to get people out of the system. Now, not trying to poke fun, but it's almost like they're playing game of capture the flag, but it's real life. Because I mean, I joke, but that's what it is. If you've ever played capture the flag, you're on a sample Linux system and they tell you to do this or find this file or hack this other network in a fun controlled environment. It takes time and people compete to see who could do this the fastest. Well, that's essentially what they're doing. They're diving into systems, looking for clues and things. And they keep finding that, you know, they're not finding evidence that they got everyone out because they keep trying new things and they keep trying new things when it's reported that the hacking group is doing X, Y, and Z. They're not doing X, Y, and Z. They'll go do A, B, and C instead. It's kind of incredible.
The backdoor is proving useful. It's just not for who it was created for. And that's imagine a problem that with backdoors. The moment they are created, they're not just for you. They're for everybody that knows it's there. There was this video from Veritasium probably a month ago where they actually cloned Linus from Linus Tech Tips phone and they made some calls and the calls were appearing as if they were from Linus phone. So imagine that at the network level. Imagine a telecom operator and an attacker with full access to the network operator. And imagine the type of damages that it can create. It's not even funny anymore. So, and it's not just about the snooping. People are just laser focused on the snooping part and government looking at what they're doing and the hackers looking at their calls and their records and the metadata. That's not the scary part. If you're reading about the story and you're only focused on the snooping part, you're missing out on a lot of stuff. Imagine, again, going back to AI, imagine if the attacker tries to find their potential victim's phone number and they call it and they place an AI faked voice from, "Hey Bob, this is John from management. We need to shut down production line 2 immediately because there's a problem." And it comes from John's phone, it's from John's number, it's using his voice, and it tells him to shut down production in whatever factory. Obviously, Bob is going to shut down the production line. And now you have a crippling attack. On the other hand, imagine if they fled the 911 centers with whatever random calls they want to put there to disable them or to hide some other type of operation that's going on. Or best of all, imagine if they shut down all of the networks, all of them, all of this at the same time. Because when you're inside the telecom operator's network, you have access to all of that. That's not just an imaginary problem. That's a serious risk right now. So don't stay very focused on the snooping part, because that's not even the dangerous part of this.
Right. Yeah, they're spot on. Because again, it's cascading it. And we have to keep thinking about what could come later, especially in that case. So in the story, it's mentioning Salt Typhoon emerged in October around the election, penetrated multiple communication companies. China was blamed for it, but I just want to mention China's denying involvement, just to mention that that's their response to that. But U.S. officials are claiming that they're really trying to dive deep into gathering information about their adversaries. At first, you know, the information they're ingesting, random phone numbers, random people, don't really seem like anyone important. But then later, kind of zeroing in on more important officials. So, according to this, they're deep, and neither FBI or CISA mentioned which communication companies in particular were affected by this.
Yeah, but they mentioned that theirs was the largest one, so that kind
of do the math. It really does.
Another interesting point, and again, you cannot make this up. One of the recommendations by the FBI to approach this was that customers should use end-to-end encryption. Okay? So these are the same guys from the same agency that went to the back door in the first place. And they are now telling you that you need to use end-to-end encryption. Again, if you go read them on any other day, stuff that they put out, encryption is bad and you shouldn't be using it.
Yeah,
that's a problem. Okay, and now they have the right hand is telling you to use encryption, and the left hand doesn't really want you to use encryption. So, yeah, maybe installing the backdoor in the first place could have prevented this. Right now, the genie is already out of the bottle, and you have a really tough time putting it back in again.
Yeah, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing or something. But even within the same organizations, you'll have people advocating for backdoors and people advocating for there not to be backdoors. Which is just the math only goes one direction. Follow the math. And this is one of the clearest things here. But you're right, that's a great example.
So part about the backdoor. There was, and again, if you want to go back, it was one of the episodes that we did during the summer, probably in July. There was a story that I talked about on the podcast about legislation that was going to go through the EU Parliament. And it was scheduled to go through a few days after the podcast went live, about some legislation that would mandate that it should be possible for law enforcement to look at messages before they were encrypted. Obviously, this was ridiculous. It was, again, a backdoor, and it was bad for all of the obvious reasons, some of them we have just pointed out in the previous story. So at the time, the groups and the parties behind the proposal, they couldn't get the votes, so they pulled the proposal and everybody forgot about it for a few months. It's coming back again, and they want it to be passed again. And as always, this type of legislation will always come wrapped into child protection laws, and nobody can defend anything that does not protect the children, obviously, but this type of approach is not useful for that. It's not going to solve the problem, and it's going to cause way, way more problems at many different levels, and it's never going to be the solution that law enforcement is hoping that it will.
Right.
It's a problem. It's going to go back again. If you want to look something up again, look for chat control and EU Parliament. It's going to go back for a vote again, and it should not get through. Obviously not because it's related to children, but because breaking encryption breaks a whole lot of things that people are not realizing at the moment. And as we've seen, the hackers will find a way through. They will be able to exploit this. It's not going to be just for law enforcement. And it's not going to be just for law enforcement from the minute that it gets introduced. So please, if you have the ability, make your voice heard and don't let this get through.
Absolutely, 100%.
Another thing that we should probably look at this, and this is likely going to be the last episode of the year, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know if we have anything scheduled, but with the holidays and the season, it's very likely the last episode of the year. So, yeah, I thought about doing a year in review because 2024 has been significant for many different reasons, like every single year seems to be. But we had actually three stories this year that are probably massive stories, and on their own, on any other year before this, they would have been the biggest story in cybersecurity on its own. So we had the Xe compromise, we had the UnitedHealth ransomware, and the CrowdStrike incidents. Each of these stories has been massive and has had massive ramifications on its own. And we had all three of them happening in the span of just a few months this year. It's been an incredible roller coaster of news, and we are going to go back to those stories to look at some of the fallout that has happened. And yeah, it's really, really interesting to follow this.
Yeah, it really is. And yeah, Log4j and
crap, and wow. to cap that Log4j, 3 years old now, probably 3 years old 10 days ago of the time of recording, and it's still being abused, it's still being exploited. And Log4j was the big story in 2021, and again, nothing topped it that year. But this year we have three comparable stories. On the Xe compromise, we have the problems with the open source model just laid bare for everybody to see. We had a single developer being bullied into letting somebody else have a responsibility in the project. We had social engineering getting him to accept somebody else's proposals and to give permissions to somebody else on the project. And we saw that it introduced lots of nastiness into the code base, and yeah, all hell broke loose at the time. And everybody in cybersecurity thought that, yeah, this year is already bad, it can't be topped. And just a couple of months ago, after that, we had yet another breaking story. But the Xe compromise, and the first story that we opened it with today, about the vulnerability reports being created by AI, that's essentially two faces on the same coin. Abusing the developers and abusing the developers' time will eventually, if we cannot manage to get this under control, will eventually erode open source so much that it's probably going to break it, and it's not going to be fixable. And we really need to get some control over this. We really need to get something in place that protects developers, that protects the project, that shields them from this type of crap, and that's being nice. And make sure that things continue to work, because open source has brought us this far. We've been riding the coattails of open source developers for decades, and this has only been made more obvious with the internet. And we're still right there on the shoulders of giants, and missing out on that makes you... If we miss out on open source, we're going to be left at the mercy of companies that probably don't have your best interests in mind. So keep that in mind when you're looking and reading about these stories. This is more important than they look like at face value.
I think the best part of developing open source, at least historically, is because people want to. They like it. They enjoy it. It's fun to them. They love being involved in this. They love writing code and working with other people. And for them, this is a really great thing. The problem comes when we implement things that make it less fun, because that's the fun is why people do it. You take that away from them. Keep in mind, most of them are volunteers. So you take the fun aspect, or you put so much BS on top of it that it's not as fun. Fewer people will do it. To your point, that's an example of eroding it from the inside. We have these, you know, corporate companies putting pressure on developers to get things fixed. You know, and most of them don't even, you know, contribute money to the projects that they're demanding something from. I mean, it's just, we've talked a lot about the challenges of open source throughout the podcast. And I think once you add BS reports that come in waves and start taking the fun away from people, then That's when things start to get a little serious. And the problem is when something starts to erode, it's a cancer. By the time you realize it's happening, it's already too late. You can only fix this by fixing it, you know, early signs of something happening, which is right now. Literally, we're seeing that now. But once it gets to a certain point, just like the fall of anything else, it's too late. And then something, you can't recover from that, to your point. So just keep that in mind when, as you mentioned through these stories, because we are creating the community that our developers are working in. Let's not create a community of toxicity.
And this is exactly what happened in the XE compromise when they overwhelmed the developer with reports about bugs and questions about when the next version is coming and when something's going to be fixed. This is exactly the same type of social pressure that's being placed on open source developers. And again, you can read the story on the first story that we did. You'll have the links for this. But these types of AI crap that's being thrown at developers right now under the guise of vulnerability reports places them in the exact same position that the XE developer was in. He was overwhelmed with work. He wasn't able to comply with the demands, and I'm using air quotes here, of the people that were pressuring him. And he folded and he accepted somebody else's help, and that person turned out to be the problem. This type of pressure that the open source developers are facing right now is exactly the same type of thing that happened with the XE compromise. I wouldn't call it malicious because LLMs make this so easy that it's very easy to do this, even if you're not trying to hurt the projects. But doing it this way is not helping anybody. If you're just looking for brownie points for creating a CVE, this isn't the right way to do it. At the very least, put in the effort, like we mentioned before, take the time. And that time that you take looking at the problem that you're going to suggest is an actual CVE and merits an actual CVE, that time makes it so that you don't flood the developers. And that eases some of the pressure. But again, this is exactly the same thing as what happened with the XE problem.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it's a good point.
And another great story, and I'm going to say great here, and probably this shouldn't be the right word for it, but is the United Health ransomware incident. I'm not even going to touch what happened with United Health in the past few weeks with a really long yardstick here. I'm not going to touch that. At the time this happened, it was many months ago. It had no relation with this. But the ransomware incident, this was massive because United Health agreed to pay. And they paid an absurd amount of money at the time. So much so that it influenced the value of Bitcoins at the time. They paid the massive amount of money in ransom. They had no certainty that their data was going to come back and would not be used again. And guess what? It probably didn't come back, and it is being used again because hackers being hackers, they, again, no honor among thieves. But please, if you're facing a ransomware incident, paying the ransom is the absolutely last step that you should take. Like we said when we looked at the story in the first place, on the episode at the time, unless your data is so valuable that you have the cure for cancer right there and you have no hard copies elsewhere, and you absolutely have to recover that data and you have no other recourse or backups available to you, please don't pay the ransom. It only entices the attackers. You'll only paint a really large target on your backs. United Health is still recovering from this, and I don't pity them in any way. They're a massive company. They have enough money to cover this and more, and they made absurd amounts of money. That's not the point. The point is that by paying this, there are telling hackers that this is a profitable endeavor, that if they find enough targets and they get enough people to pay them ransoms, they're going to leave on a beach somewhere and not never be touched by law enforcement, and they're going to make a killing with what they get in ransom. Please do not pay the ransom unless you absolutely have to. These guys paid. They didn't improve their standing. Their data is still being released on the dark web, and again, the hackers loved it.
Yeah, the only way to defeat ransomware is for no one to pay it. If nobody ever pays it, ransomware is dead. There's no more financial incentive. They make exactly $0. There's no reason to do it. So the more people pay, like you were saying, more incentive, then the longer we're all going to have to deal with this. So it's not just your company when you're paying the ransom. You're supporting something that's going to cause that same pain to someone else. So you're putting money in to something that's going to cause that same pain to someone else. So I'm saying that again, because that's actually absolutely what you're doing. And it's giving them incentive. We all have to deal with more of them. And it's just not, it's not okay. Can't pay them.
And just when you thought that 2024 could not give you another big story like this, we had the CrowdStrike incident.
Oh boy.
The biggest IT outage in history was not caused by hackers, was caused by a mistake. It was a problem in an update. 8.5 million systems were brought offline, and it took a long time to get them all back up again. And by accident, this is an example of just how vulnerable the infrastructure is. This is an example of how society as a whole is vulnerable to IT problems at this type of scale. 8.5 million systems going down simultaneously on the same day. They brought airports, hospitals, schools to a standstill. Factories were closed. The impact from this was so massive, and it was accidental. Imagine if this was on purpose.
Yeah, I mean, that was the only other huge causer of blue screens of death I could think of is Windows 98. sorry, couldn't help it. But no, it was incredible because I remember, you know, I'm pretty sure you broke the news to me, as you often do, because I'm usually like so buried in my editing for the YouTube channel that sometimes I don't see the news until the end of the day. But then, you know, we covered it. We got on, I believe, that same day, and we started covering this and talking about it because you had system administrators waking up to a blue screen of death. And at first, I mean, our mindset might be, oh, well, that sucks. I'll just reimage the computer and, you know, call it a day. But wait a minute, there's this other one and this one and that one. Wait, what's going on here? There's 10 more that just dropped. And not knowing, or maybe, you know, heads down trying to figure out what's going on, and then just turn on the news and find out that other companies are also dealing with this. And as you said, is the biggest outage. So that was just, it was horrific. It was, and all the people, the hours that they had to spend to get these machines back up and running was incredible.
It probably showed some companies that they don't have plans in place to actually work around IT problems. But it actually goes deeper than that. It's not very easy to go without IT. You can't really make whatever you're making, your company produces or creates, or whatever services you actually do. It's not easy to do without IT at all. And the problem with the CrowdStrike incident was it was so massive. It was a blanket hit on every single system. It was workstations, it was servers, it was everything that had the CrowdStrike Falcon deployed. And again, I cannot stress this enough. This was accidental. It was done without malicious intent. And going back to the story about the telecom operators, hackers are in a position, as far as we can tell, to do that and much more, shutting down network communications across the US on a scale never seen before. It would only be comparable to the CrowdStrike incident if it happened. CrowdStrike was worldwide, but the network telecom communications going down across the entire US, the impact in the world economy would probably be similar. This is not a good prospect. We know the hackers are there. We know that they got in. We know that they used the backdoor that shouldn't exist. And we can't seem to be able to get them out. The amount of damage and the risk that we're in, and by we, I mean the global economy, not me personally in the US, but you, for example. But the risk that we are all in because of this, it's beyond understanding. And until you start looking at the problem with a different viewpoint than simply my privacy is being invaded, you don't really get the full grasp of the problem that we're in. whenever you hear that infrastructure is not resilient and that you cannot defend against the type of problems and all of that, it's because it's really tricky to do correctly. One thing that we've always done here in the show, start with the basics, get your patching done. Again, I know exactly that that's not just as easy as, say, patch your systems, because that's not how the real world operates. You have systems that can't go down and all of that. Look at live patching. I'm plugging TechScare services here. Look at live patching. Yeah. We can help you patch systems as your systems are running. But even if you don't, look for ways to actually keep your systems updated. Most of the times, hackers will simply exploit known vulnerabilities. Log4j being exploitable 3 years after all the fuss that it caused, after all the news that were made about it. Everybody should more than know about it, and you should never see this type of vulnerable versions of Log4j in production ever again. And after 3 years, you still haven't had the chance of updating those systems. You're really dropping the ball there.
12% of Java apps are still using the insecure version.
You're really dropping the ball on that one. And that's just an example. That's just a proverbial shining stone there. But that's just an example. It happens way more than we think.
Right.
Cybersecurity is hard. You're going to hear lots of people telling you this. Cybersecurity is hard. Cybersecurity is expensive. You need to waste the spend the money. You need to spend the time doing the training. You need to do all of that. And sometimes it won't work. Sometimes you'll still get breaches and you'll still get attacked, and the attacker will sometimes still win. It's impossible to cover all the bases all the time, but start somewhere. And this is appropriate at this time because teams are understaffed right now. It's the holiday season. Teams are probably using the last vacation days of the year that they have. There's people on vacations. There are people that are off, not reachable. Just like Log4j happened in December, there's still 2 weeks to go. 2024 has given us massive stories so far. Massive incidents that any other year would be the story of the year. This year, it's just, it's Monday. So there's still 2 more weeks until the end of the year. Who knows? It's probably the best time of the year for a hacker right now.
Yeah,
keep an eye out.
Yeah, it's a great time for hackers, because even if they don't bring systems down, someone accidentally will just do it for them.
Maybe we get another CrowdStrike update before the end of the year. Who knows?
Hopefully it's better than a Good Eats or whatever gift card that was that they were giving out. Uber Eats, I think. Don't quote me on what it was they gave out, but I remember like a $10 gift card. Maybe, something more exciting than that.
That's the cheery spirit of the season right there. No. Enjoy the holidays. If you're going to be one of the lucky ones that's going to be on vacations for these weeks, enjoy those vacations. Have a great new year. Enjoy the seasonal greetings, whatever those may be for you. And we'll be right here in the start of the next year. Thank you much for joining. As always, it was a pleasure. And until the next one.
See you next year.